Hey, everybody. Before we get to today's podcast, Brandon and I want to tell you about something exciting that maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't. It's a new project that we've launched that we're offering to you called Intensive Care Academy.
Yes, ICA is now live. It is a web-based, video-based teaching platform. Many ways similar to this podcast, but it is videos, it is a little more structured and more rigorous and more comprehensive, and it's just another way for us to teach critical care. So if you're interested in this, we think you might be interested in that. Currently, what you'll find there is the Foundations program, which is over 50 lessons intended to orient somebody new to critical care, kind of targeted at the new critical care APP, like a NP or a PA starting critical care with no prior training, kind of going through everything from A to Z, from diseases to treatments to diagnosis to procedures. And we're going to continue to have new content all the time for different folks. You'll also get access to two new private podcast feeds, one with audio versions of the lessons to review, and ICA Pearls, which is the new home for the Turbos, which are leaving the free podcast here. Also, live Q&A sessions with us and a lot more. If that interests you, and we're hoping it will, go check it out, ICU101.com. It's ICU101. And let us know what you think.
Now, on with the podcast.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
You.
We have a special guest with us today. We're going to talk a little bit about blood transfusions, which is something I think we all do, but probably don't think that much about. And so we thought we'd get an expert to help us out. So Dr. Joe Chaffin is here. He is a transfusion expert. He's a transfusion medicine educator at Loma Linda University in California. He's done a wide variety of things within his career, all related to transfusion medicine, but his real passion is education. And so he has a website, Blood Bank Guy, and a podcast, Blood Bank Guy Podcast, that he's run since 2016. And he's going to come on our podcast and share a little bit of his knowledge with us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me.
So, Joe, I hope we could kind of make use of you for is just to take the, honestly, I think kind of cursory understanding that a lot of us on the clinical side have of transfusion and expand it a little. I mean, we're not all going to become experts, but I honestly think it is the ratio of how often we do this to how much we know about it is probably worse here than for most of what we do. I don't know, maybe that's okay. But, you know, also as a topic where the specialists, the transfusion medicine folks like you, can be kind of scarce in a lot of settings. Many of us in all but the largest centers I may have never interacted with anybody from the blood bank other than maybe the, you know, the techs who, you know, call to tell you something about your samples. But so this is kind of an opportunity for you to connect with all the folks who are doing this and just kind of expand what we know a little bit.
So, you know, Brandon, if I can interject for just a second, right? Something that's really fascinating to me that I've always been amazed at is that if you look at just about any hospital in the United States, and this is probably true worldwide, I've only seen statistics in the United States, but just about every hospital in the United States, the number one medical procedure in that hospital is blood transfusion. And it goes all the way back to medical school, where most people maybe get, if physicians anyway, maybe get like an hour, if two, if they're lucky, of quote unquote education on transfusion medicine. And it's wild that we're doing that many of these procedures without a lot of background. And it's the reason, as you said earlier, Brian, it's my professional passion to try and close that gap a little bit. That's why I do the podcast. That's why I do my website. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're absolutely correct. We're dealing with not a lack of good intention, but unfortunately, in some cases, a lack of some fundamental knowledge.
That's a good point. I'd never really thought of it that way, that like a procedure, right? Yep. But it is, and you're right. And here's the other weird thing, right? I probably got more training in school about transfusing IV fluid, crystalloid, mm-hmm. than I did about transfusing blood products.
I completely believe that.
Which is just
I
completely believe salt that. Water. So,
yeah. Which is a safer, lower cost thing, but yeah, you learn more about it.
In our parlance in transfusion medicine, we basically describe transfusion as a liquid transplant, which when you think about it, and as we've learned more and more about blood transfusion and all the things that go into blood transfusion, all the components that potentially have obviously life-saving effects, but also potentially harmful effects if you're not careful, you really need to think about it that way in terms of really respecting what you're doing. No one would do an organ transplant just kind of willy-nilly, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it really literally is taking a part of someone else, giving it to your patient, and it shouldn't just be done casually.
Yeah, not to hijack, because I know Brandon has a case and stuff for you, but why do you think that is? Why are we so cavalier towards this?
Well, unfortunately, again, I think it stems, Brian, from a lack of full understanding of all the potential ramifications of blood transfusion. I mean, I'm sure some of the stuff we'll talk about today will include some of the potentially harmful effects of transfusion, but it's absolutely clear, obviously, in the right setting, blood transfusion saves lives. But when you're not clear on all the things that potentially could happen, I'll give you an example. I recently, not at Loma Linda where I'm working, but in another role that I have working with other hospitals, I came across some information on informed consent that physicians were giving to patients before they transfused. And it was almost entirely focused on HIV transmission, which is great and wonderful. But unfortunately, it's like, let's go back to the 80s, because the reality is we haven't had a single HIV transmission through blood since 2008. And that was an incredibly weird and statistically almost impossible situation. Before that, it was basically before the turn of the century. Wow. So we're talking about a scenario that does not happen very often in terms of HIV. And unfortunately, I think because we've gotten so much better at HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C transmission, we're way better at that than we used to be. People have a tendency to go, sigh of relief, all is good, let's just go. And unfortunately, there are so many other potential things where blood can interact with patients, again, for life-saving effect, but needs to be in the right clinical setting.
All right. Well, what I wanted to focus on today really is transfusion reactions, which is something we all mm-hmm. kind of talk about, but I think usually not in much depth. So let's say we have a 50-year-old male in our ICU who's critically ill. Never mind why. But as many of our patients do, his hemoglobin levels kind of drift down over the course of his admission. And one morning we check and it's 6.7. So the team plans to give him a unit of packed red blood cells. And typically in most centers, this requires consent. So you would usually consent either the patient or in a patient who maybe can't be consented, would usually talk to a family about it. But we kind of briefly talked about consent already. What should we be talking about when we have these conversations? You know, because consent is kind of can be a delicate topic. You want to give an honest and accurate portrayal of risks to people, but I'm not sure we really know what those are. And of course, while also not overweighing risks, I mean, it is something we do every day and generally is safe. So what do you think we should tell people? What are the meaningful risks and what are, at least in a ballpark sense, the degree of those risks?
Great question. So the informed consent process, as you guys are very aware, is something that that has certainly evolved over the years. It's certainly in transfusion medicine gone from as I said before, what's the risk of HIV to what else could potentially happen. Just to give you some basic raw numbers, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do think that the possibility of infection from the transfusion should be mentioned, but it also should be mentioned with a really simple to remember number. The risk of HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C from blood transfusion currently is thought to be at least 1 in 3 million transfusions. And again, you guys, I don't need to, I'm preaching to the choir with this crew. When you say 1 in 3 million, that doesn't mean that, hey, we're at 2,999,000, we're bound to get one. I mean, we've done 25 plus million transfusions a year since that last HIV infection in 2008. So it's a statistical risk greater than one in a million. You guys know to statisticians is an almost never event.
But so I think the risk of each of those is not equal, but they're all so low that it's not meaningful to differentiate between them.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I suggest just using that one in 3 million number, and understanding that with modern testing that we have in transfusion medicine, it's by far the best testing that we've ever had. We're able to detect, for example, an HIV infection within about 8 to 9 days of infection. Blood donors are the best people on the planet. I'll go to my grave saying that. So it's, again, really low risk population with a super sensitive testing. The risk is incredibly small. But in addition, the biggest risk, quite frankly, from transfusion are things like mistransfusion, where unfortunately, and obviously we take great pains and great amount of training to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen. But if, for example, a tube is drawn from a patient and the person doing the drawing doesn't label that tube at the bedside, goes out and grabs a label that, oops, isn't quite the right label, and it's the label for someone else who transfusion had been ordered. We call that wrong blood in the tube, and it's garbage in, garbage out from the beginning. Again, you're not going to talk extensively about this to a patient, but the risk of a mistransfusion resulting in hemolysis of the blood, which is transfused to a patient, is far greater than HIV. That happens in the range of 1 in 75,000 transfusions. Again, most of those, believe it or not, are not fatal transfusion reactions in many cases because we get lucky, and the ABO interactions aren't such to cause severe damage. But bottom line, the risk of hemolyzing the blood product that's given to the patient is something that should absolutely be considered. There are potential effects of transfusion in terms of there's information that we've known about for a long time, but is still a little bit unclear what it means. But in terms of immunosuppression that results from transfusion, that's very difficult to quantify. But there is data and has been data out there for a long time that transfusion does somewhat immunosuppress a recipient. And there has been discussion over the years of that kind of thing increasing the potential for postoperative infections, the potential for cancer recurrence, case for case, you know, stage for stage in cancer surgeries, for example, those who get transfused versus those who don't get transfused. There seems to be a somewhat higher risk of recurrence in the ones who are transfused. Again, so immunomodulatory effects of transfusion, very difficult to quantify, but again, something that is a part of really any consideration of transfusion. The simple things that can happen, of course, things like urticaria, just a simple urticarial transfusion reaction where someone's getting transfused and they just get hives. Very simple, typically a reaction to donor plasma proteins. Very easy to deal with, but that can range all the way up to the severe allergic reaction, the so-called anaphylactic transfusion reaction, where within the first few drops of the transfusion, the patient just crashes, full anaphylaxis. That is, again, quite uncommon. It's last number I saw with that, I don't even want to quote it because I'm not actually 100% solid on that number, but it's considerably less likely than some of the others, but it's still absolutely a possibility. And again, simple fever during transfusion, which can lead to exposure to another unit because we may talk about this later, we may need to check and see if the person is actually having an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction. Things of that nature, the mild transfusion reactions are often nuisance reactions, but they are things that people do need to be aware of. I'll just give you an example and I'll stop sermonizing here for just a second. You got me started, Brandon. So the simple urticarial reaction that I mentioned before, which to us in medicine is like, what's the big deal? They have a few hives. Give them some Benadryl, move along. To patients, that freaks them out. And if your patient is sitting there and they're not medical and they look down and they're looking at their arm and they're seeing pop, 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 hives, urticaria popping up all over the place, it's the emotional cost of that is actually greater than I think we really believe, than we think. And I have seen many cases, innumerable cases, where people are so freaked out about that they refuse transfusion from that point forward. So at any rate, again, a lot of potential more minor things all the way up to the major things, figuring out the balance of how much to say. My advice to people, generally speaking, is to, and I do this with hospitals all the time, to work on an informed consent document to give those doing consent an outline. You don't want to remember all those numbers, that's silly, but to have an outline and have a general idea of the main complications of transfusion so that you can communicate those clearly to your patient and they have an appropriate idea. One thing I will mention, Brandon, is that you mentioned that transfusion medicine experts are somewhat scarce. You can almost always find in the pathology department a pathologist who has had at least some training in transfusion medicine. And I can't speak for every pathologist, obviously, but the majority of them are willing to at least assist you in that process and work through an intelligent way to work on your informed consent.
So this patient is consented. A type and screen is done. The patient is A positive with a negative antibody screen. So they cross match you into blood and they start transfusing. About an hour into this, you're called to the bedside because this person has developed chills. It kind of looks like shaking Rigers and has spiked a fever of 38.3 degrees. So the nurse says, what do we do? What should, you know, the clinician's approach to this sort of thing be at the bedside? I mean, we just heard about it. The patient's getting blood. Now what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is where there's the practical answer and there's the answer that you're going to get from me every time you ask me about this. So here's my basic philosophy on this, you guys. The simple fact is, This is a very, very little known fact that I'm about to share with you, and it's super important. Fully 80%, 4 out of 5 acute hemolytic transfusion reactions present with nothing more than a little bit of fever and maybe some chills. Nothing more. That's how they present. At the time when you can make a difference and stop it and find out that they're having acute hemolysis, you simply cannot. I don't care if you're God's gift to medicine. You simply cannot tell it apart from a benign febrile non-hemolytic transfusion reaction in the early stages. And what I see a lot is, in particular, more senior physicians and medical personnel, seeing something like what you're describing and saying, I've seen this a million times. And I know what this is. It's just another benign fever during transfusion. I'm going to tell the nurse to go ahead and give some acetaminophen if the patient is able to take it, if the patient's with and can take it. And keep watch on the patient, but continue to transfuse. Here's what I tell physicians about this all the time. If you choose to do that, most of the time, statistically speaking, probably the vast majority of the time, you're going to be right. Statistically speaking, the febrile non-hemolytic reaction happens in the range of 1 in 100 to 1 in 300 or so transfusions, somewhere in that ballpark. And they're way more common than an acute hemolytic reaction. But the point is, if you wait until the patient is crashing to make the diagnosis, you can bring the janitor in and the janitor can look and say, something ain't right there. I don't know what that is. You don't need a medical degree or any specialized training to recognize an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction when it's gone to the point where the patient is crashing. The point is to try and stop it before then. The point is to make the diagnosis because quite simply, and this is especially true in ICU settings and settings where patients are already more ill, the number one thing that determines whether a patient lives or dies from an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction is simply this: how much incompatible blood did they get? Mil for mil, the risk goes up. The likelihood that they're going to die goes up. The likelihood that they're going to kick off into DIC, that they're going to crash, that they're going to trash their kidneys, that they're going to do all the stuff that people with acute hemolytic reactions do that everybody's learned about as the ultimate, you know, this is how an acute hemolytic reaction looks, the idea that we have in our head. The simple fact is most of them don't look that way at the beginning. So my answer to your question is, and I think this is reasonable advice at any time. Anytime someone says something to me, Mr. So-and-so in bed, whatever, was having a transfusion, and I pretty much stop him right there. I'm not a rude person, but I stop him right there. And I say, okay, before you tell me more, have we just stopped the flow of blood? We don't have to disconnect anything. Every infusion set has a little pinch roller. Just stop the flow of blood, keep the IV access, just stop the flow of blood, and let's just talk through this for a second. If you even do that, that's better, in my opinion, than just saying, little fever, give him some Tylenol and go. Now, in terms of how we can work that up in the transfusion service, I can certainly talk about that, but the general approach, again, in my opinion, if you ask a transfusion medicine doc, every time we're gonna say, stop it, work it up, make sure it's not acute hemolysis. If you ask someone who's taking care of patients all the time at the bedside, they're in many cases gonna say, I've seen so many of these, it's always worked for me to just go ahead and give some acetaminophen and go. Last thing I'll say about that, if it truly is acute hemolysis, and again, I say this to physicians of all kinds all the time, of all experience levels, if it truly is acute hemolysis, and this is the time that you're wrong, I have been on the unfortunate end of having to call the Food and Drug Administration and tell them that we have killed a patient at our hospital because we ignored a fever during transfusion. I've done that multiple times as my responsibility as a blood bank medical director. And in every one of those circumstances, every single one, someone got called, someone said, give him some Tylenol and go, and the patient died. Now, I can't give you the fraction for how many went successfully that I never heard about, but I can certainly tell you what can happen. And I guess what I would say is that on the day that you're wrong, you're going to regret that for the rest of your career, because there's no real great coming back from that in terms of medical legal implications and simply just how you're going to feel about yourself after something like that occurs.
So is a reasonable middle ground to say always stop the transfusion, but maybe if you keep an eye and they seem okay, maybe you could restart it? Or do you think you need to be worked up in each case?
Well, again, if you ask a transfusion medicine doc, that's what we're going to say. We're going to say that every time. What I always suggest is, because, I mean, as you guys know, if you do the workup, that normally means disconnecting, sending the unit back to the transfusion service after checking at the bedside to make sure everything matches up, the clerical check, if you will, sending a post-transfusion sample, and they're going to do, they're going to spin it down and look for hemolysis in the plasma. They're going to do a direct antiglobulin test or a direct Coombs test, as people often call it, to see if there's any incompatibility, any antibodies on the red cells that weren't there before. And they're also going to typically repeat the ABO and RH testing on that post-transfusion specimen. In most cases, that leads to a delay in transfusion, right? And that's the problem. I get it. I understand completely. So what I have implemented in some places where I am and where I've worked, and I tell you this knowing that I'm, every transfusion medicine doc who ever listens to this is going to go, how dare he say such a thing? But I have worked with clinical teams in the past to do a somewhat abbreviated scenario to actually work with my transfusion service staff to make it basically a drop everything situation. In other words, yes, stop the flow. And the first answer, Brandon, by the way, is I always think you should stop the flow of blood. I always think that, at least to pause for a moment and evaluate the situation. But after you pause, I have worked this out in some places where I've worked for them to send a purple top tube to the blood bank. We can spin it down really fast. That visual hemoglobin check literally takes moments. That we can run a DAT, which takes a little bit longer, and repeat things, but we can do it in such a time frame that you still have time to get the unit in, so you don't lose the unit.
Can we send the blood back, and the blood bank can have fun with it, and you can have a different unit of blood?
That's absolutely what normally happens, Brandon. That's absolutely what normally happens. But you also have to understand that once that unit of blood leaves monitored storage, whether that monitored storage is, someone walking to the blood bank, one of your staff walking to the blood bank and taking a unit in their hot little hands and walking up to the ICU, or if you're in a hospital that sends units out in coolers where the cooler is sitting there by the bedside, you open up the cooler, take the unit out. From the moment the hot little hands thing or the moment the unit comes out of the cooler, you have 4 hours to infuse it. 4 full hours is the time frame that you have to basically get that transfusion in. So if a hospital transfusion service can work with you to kind of save the unit and keep you from having to get a new unit, that's something that I have implemented. Now, I will tell you, most places don't do that. Most places, when they do a workup, you're going to send the unit back. They're going to do all their work. They're going to tell you, in most cases, everything's fine. Here's a new unit, and you're going to start afresh, basically.
So, assuming a case like this truly is an acute hemolytic reaction,
yes.
This has become such a rare event that I think probably the majority of clinicians have never even seen a case. I mean, you learn about it, but we don't have a good framework for it. So, I mean, mm-hmm. just understanding how to, you know, approach and treat these patients. Of course, we can involve the blood bank and so on. But, I mean, this process really is mediated by massive hemolysis, right? Can we treat this in supportive ways the same way we would treat anyone who is having hemolysis? Maybe in the same realm as someone with something like a really bad rhabdomyolysis, which of course is a little bit different. It's from skeletal muscle and so on. But
sure.
I mean, because you'll see references on how to treat these acute hemolytic reactions. A lot of it is like, it seems like it's sort of just non-critical care. It's like you know, make sure they have IVs. Like, well, okay, well, no yep. shit. All of our patients have, you know, whatever. I mean, whatever. Like, I'd give them fluids. If they were hypotensive, I'd give them pressors, support their breathing, and mm-hmm. so on. Is it as simple as mm-hmm. that? Or do we need to, like, approach this differently in some way?
Great question. So unfortunately, most of the treatment is supportive. There are a few things that people have talked about doing. One of them being actually getting your therapeutic apheresis team in there and doing a red cell exchange, taking out the bad red cells, putting in red cells that aren't going to be hemolyzed. I personally haven't found most patients being stable enough to do that. But for the most part, Brandon, what you're dealing with is essentially, especially if we're talking about an ABO mismatch, where, for example, our patient is group O and through a mistyping or something of that nature, or even something as simple as someone walking into a room on the ward where two patients are and having a unit of group A red cells that's supposed to go to that patient and instead giving it to the group O patient in that bed. God forbid that should happen. It rarely happens. But when it does, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. So when you have ABO mismatch, the hemolysis in those situations tends to be intravascular and severe. With most other blood groups, the Rh blood group, of course, being the most famous one, but there are multiple other blood group antibodies that can cause hemolysis. Those are usually extravascular, so happening in the spleen primarily, generally less dramatic clinically. But the intravascular ABO ones are the ones where the hemolysis happens right where the red cells are, so that it's a very dramatic, very severe level of hemolysis. You get basically from as the red cells blow apart, the way I describe it is the cytokine storm. You've got cytokines just released everywhere that are stimulating your coag system, that are telling your brain to increase your body temperature, that are changing things in your vascular system, basically massive blood pressure drop as a result of many of these cytokines that are being released, and things like nitric oxide and stuff that get stimulated by some of these other pathways. You guys could probably describe those pathways better than me. I'm a pathologist, but what I'm saying is you end up in a scenario where you're supporting blood pressure, you're supporting their vasculature in general, you're trying to keep their kidneys functional. And the reality is that when all these things are going on and your body is you're dropping your pressures like crazy, the way I describe it is a very elementary way of looking at it. Basically, when you're in fight or flight, when your blood pressure is dropping like crazy and you're trying to reverse that, sympathetic stimulation does a wonderful job of increasing your blood pressure, but does a crappy job of allowing blood to go to your kidneys. So you mentioned rhabdomyolysis and that scenario. Well, myoglobin does a really bad job on the kidneys. Free hemoglobin, not quite as bad. So renal damage is often more acute tubular necrosis from lack of blood flow than it is from actual physical damage of the of the substances released from the red cells. I don't know if that helps, but bottom line, you're mostly supportive.
Is the this cascade mostly due to the hemolysis and all these downstream effects? Because or is there a problem with oxygen delivery, because all the hemolysis should be of the transfused cells, right? Like these patients shouldn't become anemic.
In the vast majority of situations, that's true. There is one exception to that in sickle cell patients in particular, where they can potentially, transfusion can induce the so-called hyperhemolysis scenario where they don't just trash their own, the transfused red cells, but they actually start trashing their own red cells. But aside from that, generally speaking, yes, the cells that are going to be hemolyzed are the cells that were just transfused.
Okay. And what's the time course here? You know, how long until these patients get better? I mean, it's a one-time event, yeah. Right? So
it is. It should be anyway, right? and when you look at the risk of acute hemolytic reactions happening, which, as I mentioned before, is about 1 in 75 or 76,000 transfusions, but the fatality rate is considerably less than that. Like, it's close to 1 in a million in some studies. So, you know, again, people getting acute hemolysis doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to die. And my transfusion medicine colleagues are sitting there going, oh, Joe, way to tell them that, because now they're going to take it even less seriously. But it's, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It's the simple fact is, if you are a reasonably healthy person without a whole lot else going on, and if the hemolytic reaction is caught early enough, and we don't have that, you know, excessive amount, a full unit of blood, for example, can really do a bad job on people, then the likelihood that someone with fairly good protoplasm is going to die is relatively low. But someone who starts off sick, man, that's bad news, man. A hemolytic reaction on top of someone who's already critically ill can really be the thing that pushes someone over quickly. You mentioned time frame. I don't really have a specific time frame. I mean, if you get the kidneys working well and you're supporting the patient, you know, I've seen acute hemolytic reactions where by the next day people are significantly, you know, I mean, almost like it never happened. I've also seen ones, again, in people that were more ill where it led to extensive ICU stays as a result of the things that, you know, when people kick off into DIC, the challenges that come from that.
The hemolysis is over, but okay.
Exactly.
All right. So let's say another day, another patient on the ventilator. A lot going on with this patient. You know, they're ill, they're being resuscitated, they're intubated. But this patient also has blood transfused in the setting of their other instability. And the patient becomes more hypoxemic, and there's a little bit more pulmonary edema noted on their imaging over the next, let's say, 12 hours. So, you know, no one really makes anything of it at the time because there's so much going on. But the next morning, we're all standing around in a circle, as we like to do, and someone reflects that maybe this is trolley, because there seems to be a temporal association with a little bit of worse pulmonary edema with the transfusion. Trolley can, I find, be tricky in our setting, because maybe in a really fulminant case and a stable patient, it could be kind of obvious. But if it's a little more subacute and more is going on, it can be kind of hard to parse out from the background of other critical illness. Is there a way to diagnose trolley, or do we have to guess at it?
No, that's a great question. There are actually international consensus criteria for the diagnosis of trolley. One thing that it does include, you mentioned over this scenario that you're describing happened over 12 hours, there is a hard and fast within 6 hours of the end of transfusion rule for trolley. So if you got respiratory stuff happening beyond 6 hours after trolley, you can't call it, after transfusion finishes, you can't call it trolley. That's again, international consensus criteria. So basically I can tell you what the criteria are. The criteria include, well, I mean, I have them here. I had a feeling you might ask me about trolley. So the definitive criteria, and what I'm reading from right now is the CDC hemovigilance criteria, which are it's the only standardized criteria for transfusion reactions in the United States. That's kind of interesting that there's only one set of standardized criteria. We're encouraged to use these to categorize transfusion reactions. So definitive trolley involves no evidence of acute lung injury prior to transfusion, and then the onset of symptoms within 6 hours after the transfusion finishes, with hypoxemia defined as the PaO2 to FiO2 less than or equal to 300, O2 sat less than 90% on room air, or other clinical evidence, along with radiographic, so chest X-ray evidence of bilateral infiltrates. And this is key, no evidence of left atrial dysfunction. So, in other words,
they can't, they're not allowed to have trolley if they have heart failure.
If they have heart failure, you can't definitively call it trolley, unfortunately. It's one of the holes in the categorization scheme. We used to have something that we called, I think it was possible trolley? Words to that effect. That was actually eliminated in the most recent revision of the international criteria. But
so obviously the physiology could occur. We just don't have a definition that makes it clear cut.
Exactly.
And really what we're talking about here, if they clearly got worse after transfusion, would be differentiating trolley from taco, right?
You got it. My least favorite acronym in medicine, taco. I have a hard time saying taco seriously, but sorry, that's just me. Yes, the distinction from the transfusion medicine perspective of trolley versus taco transfusion-associated circulatory overload is one that we deal with a lot and on a near daily basis, frankly. We talk about this distinction a lot, especially in busier hospitals. We have this come up often. The mechanism's obviously completely different between the two. The timing even different. The definition of taco allows you 12 hours after transfusion to get those respiratory symptoms. Silly, in my opinion, but that's what the criteria say. And I don't know how deeply you want to go into the pathophysiology of trolley, but generally speaking, trolley is a blood donor issue on top of an underlying patient problem. So in other words, trolley rarely happens in recipients who are just like completely healthy, normal, everything's fine. Of course, how often are you transfusing someone who's completely normal, everything's fine? But in particular, in critical care settings, patients that have stuff going on, and again, there's a huge list, anything that can put you in a heightened inflammatory state, it basically primes your neutrophils. The villain of the piece in trolley is your neutrophils. And it's in particular your pulmonary neutrophils, because as you guys know, about a third of your granulocytes live basically along the border, the interface between your alveoli and your pulmonary capillaries. And that's a good place for them to be, because if you breathe something in, you want the neutrophils there to fight stuff off. But the heightened inflammatory state sets those neutrophils up in a what we call primed position. And then the transfusion, for example, might be from a blood donor who has anti-HLA antibodies. That's the most common scenario. And those HLA antibodies from the donor come in and they're incompatible with the recipient's HLA antigens. Those HLA antigens are present on the granulocytes. The antibodies basically push the granulocytes over the edge into starting to do what granulocytes do, which is to crank out reactive oxygen species and put out toxic enzymes and basically kill bacteria, except there's no bacteria there. And so they damage the pulmonary endothelium and the underlying alveoli. Fluid, more exudative than transudative, pours into that alveolar space, and thus we get the scenario of trolley. Again, I'm not sure if you wanted to go that deep into the pathophysiology, but that's the basic look at trolley.
Well, you know, differentiating essentially cardiogenic from non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema is not a rare question in our world. And many times, frankly, not an answerable question. I mean, we can get all kinds of additional data on it. But is there any laboratory tools that can say this patient had trolley, or it's really just clinical gestalt?
Great question. So the diagnosis of trolley is largely a clinical and radiologic diagnosis. Unfortunately, the idea that waiting until we can get the blood donor in to test them for HLA antibodies, that's actually not part of the criteria. That's just kind of supportive. If you get that, that's great. But truth be told, I was fudging a little bit. It can actually happen without those antibodies. So it's not something to fully rely on. About the only thing that we suggest in those settings from the laboratory perspective that might help to some extent is, well, NT-proBNP and you know, depending on what your hospital has, that might help if it's sky high, obviously. As you guys know better than I, the pitfall of relying on an isolated NT-proBNP or BNP level to look for someone with overload. But there aren't a whole lot more really good tools. I mean,
you're
there's
saying
some clinical
they
clues.
May call in the donor and do testing, though, down the road?
Oh, yeah. So anytime a blood donor center hears about a patient who has transfusion-related acute lung injury or is even suspected of having transfusion-related acute lung injury, the hospital transfusion service will let the blood collection center know about that. And the Blood Donor Center will, in virtually all situations, they'll investigate it. And if the donor, for example, is a female who's had children, you can pretty much guarantee that she's going to get HLA antibody tested. Blood donor centers vary on whether they test males who have not been transfused, but some test everybody. Bottom line is that there will be investigation at the blood donor center level of the donor, but unfortunately, that can take a while, and you kind of need to make a decision on what you're dealing with more rapidly than what the donor center will be able to help you with.
Right. So, you know, when we have someone who we suspect either trolley or taco, I know that the blood bank would probably like us to notify them that we suspect that this occurred. I'm sure that's because it gets reported and it sounds like there can be some testing done. I can tell you that those reasons may not be too compelling to a really busy ICU person who knows that it's not going to affect their treatment. Are there other important reasons that we should be reporting these things? Because if someone gave a unit of blood and we think it's volume overloaded, we're just going to treat that. I mean, we're probably just going to, it's just like I gave them fluid. Who cares? I mean, do you guys care?
I get that. Do we care? Yeah, well, of course we care, but we also understand that in the United States, we have a passive reporting system for transfusion reactions. So nobody's required to notify us of anything technically, though, you know, again, it's best practice to do so. And I would give you as an example, in the case of a trolley, for example. But what you have to understand is that blood donor centers very rarely collect one product from one donor. We're almost always getting multiple products from one donor. If they donate whole blood, you can pretty much guarantee there will be a unit of red cells, there'll be a unit of plasma, whether that's FFP or plasma frozen within 24 hours, or maybe even broken down further into cryoprecipitate. There will always be more than one. If someone has donated platelets, in virtually all situations, there will be at least two doses of platelets, one of which may have gone to your hospital, one of which may be going to another hospital or have already gone. And in many cases, we actually get three or more doses of platelets from one individual donor. Again, the point is, what the blood center does when they hear about a reaction like transfusion-related acute lung injury, not taco, I mean, but if you hear about a trolley, we immediately drop everything and see where, do we have any other units from this donor either in our inventory or out at one of our other hospitals that we serve? And we do everything we can to get that unit out of circulation. So, if somebody truly has trolley, that's a crappy day for us. We don't really want to have an even crappier day by having more than one trolley reaction.
So are you saying that donor is more likely to induce trolley in other recipients? Because I thought it was more of a kind of interaction between these two.
It is, but it is generally speaking, a transfusion-related acute lung injury, when it's induced by HLA antibodies in a donor hitting a susceptible recipient, there has to be incompatibility between the HLA antibodies and the recipient. And that may not be true in another transfusion, but we don't know that up front. We don't know.
So the mere fact they have HLA antibodies makes them high risk to donate.
Okay. Exactly. We want to get those units out of circulation once we know that they have HLA antibodies. And, you know, we've done a lot of work in recent years, you guys, to decrease the incidence of trolley by testing some of our donors. For example, female donors that have been pregnant more than once are automatically tested for HLA antibodies in blood donor centers before they give any product that's what we call a plasma-rich product, like a platelet unit or an FFP unit that's, I mean, you can imagine antibodies are going to be mostly in plasma, right? So those are the highest risk units for trolley. So we've cut the numbers down dramatically for trolley by doing that.
Well, and so they used to teach that the most common product causing this was plasma, but then I've heard that's no longer true anymore. Can you get this from any product?
You can. Yeah, you can. Any product can do it. Historically, plasma-rich products like platelets and FFP were the most common. But since we've undertaken those interventions, really for the last 7-8 years or so, any of those products either come from males, females who have never been pregnant, or females who have been pregnant and tested negatively for HLA antibodies. But unfortunately, again, the dirty little secret is you don't have to have antibodies for trolley to occur. That's why we haven't gotten it to zero. It's reduced it. And you can see that in the fatalities curve when you look at the number of fatalities that are reported to the FDA. You know, back 20 years ago, we were seeing 35 or more fatal trolley reactions every year. The last reported one to the FDA was 2020. FDA is always behind on these, but I think in fiscal year 21 there were 4 or 5 fatalities from trolley in the United States. Way better, not zero, but way better.
Okay. So if you gave someone a unit of, say, red cells, you shouldn't say, oh, this can't be trolley.
Great. Yes. So thank you for following up with that, Brian. Yes. In fact, if you look at the number, because of those interventions we've made with the plasma-rich products, in fact, today, the most common blood product to cause fatal trolley is red blood cells.
Okay.
So yeah, even the small amount of plasma that's in there can be enough.
Okay. And you said there's not really a laboratory role in the acute setting for diagnosing trolley or, of course, taco. And yet, if you report these things, I always seem to have the blood bank ask that we draw samples and send them stuff. Is this just to have one protocol for everything? Or, I mean,
yeah, generally speaking, it pretty much is. I mean, so our big role in the workup of acute transfusion reactions, the transfusion reactions that are happening, you know, obviously while the patient's getting transfused or shortly after the patient's getting transfused, our big role is to rule out acute hemolysis. We're always going to focus on that just because it can be such a chameleon. Now, granted, if someone is presenting with pure respiratory symptoms, the likelihood that we're going to find anything on that basic workup that's looking primarily for hemolysis is almost nil. But blood banks tend to be dogmatic about these things, and they still often, generally, usually, pretty much always are going to ask you to send them samples to do that regular transfusion reaction workup.
Brian, what else should we talk about?
I think this has been really good. You know, I appreciate your sort of dualistic approach here to the being the blood bank person, but also understanding what it's like, you know, in the ICU. And I think that, you know, I was thinking when you were talking about the potential for, you know, maybe this is an acute hemolytic reaction and we should stop and do all this stuff, even though the odds are it's not. And I thought, you know, we probably have a lot of listeners who are like, man, that feels like overkill, right? But I think what I thought of was a situation that I run into not infrequently with airway, right? And I told a student one time, you know, when you have people that deal with something, right, over and over again, you get a person that goes one of two ways. They either become very, very respectful of it and appreciative of the things that can go wrong, or you become very cavalier towards it, right? And mm-hmm. I see this with airway, right? We have people that deal with airway a lot, and they go, I extubate people all the time and that are shady, and I've never had a problem, right? Whereas I work with a bunch of anesthesiologists who are super... probably, I mean, I know for a fact, I've heard people say it, right? That we're over the top conscientious about it. But one of my attendings said one time, all it takes is one time, right? Yeah. All it takes is for it to go wrong once. It doesn't matter how many times you've gotten away with it. All it takes is one time for it to go wrong. And that's what I was thinking of the whole time you were talking about that. You know, it doesn't matter how many times you've been like, fine, just give the Tylenol and don't worry about it. All it takes is one time for that to become a really bad day. And I think that we probably don't appreciate that because we are the people who are cavalier about it, right? And so I think maybe thinking about it that way might help people. Like, think of the thing that you're really, you know, I don't want to say anal about, but you know, you really worry That's about, fair. And say we have to do it the right way. And other people are like, whatever, you know, you're overly sensitive, and that's this, right? So.
There's two groups
of people that I always find are like what they're mostly will talk about is safety, is the blood bank and the pharmacy. Those are people who are always talking about how do we make sure that things don't go wrong. And these are not people who say things like, oh, who knows? It's fine. Let's give it a whirl, stuff like that. They're like the advocates for safety. If we want to give something a whirl, then they'll say, well, Mel, here's how we can do it most safely or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that's because those two places, there's probably more potential to do harm than most of the rest of the hospital. You could kill thousands of people with what's in the blood bank and what's in the pharmacy. And there's, like you said, not a lot of room between routine and a real disaster sometimes.
You're right. And in fact, ironically, the blood bank and the pharmacy are the two places that are tightly regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA considers blood a drug, and we operate under basically the same principles and rules and regulations that the pharmacy people do. And just like pharmacy, the FDA can walk into our hospital or our blood donor center or anything along the way and plop themselves down, show their little badge and say, hey, we're from the FDA and we're going to look at every piece of paper, every computer stroke you've generated since the last time we were here. And they do. So blood banks tend to be a little bit gun shy and a little bit, I mean, I think it's fair to call us compulsive about that stuff, Brian. You're not wrong when you say that. Yeah. And, you know, again, if you ask us, what you're going to get is almost always a conservative answer. Now, I've spent a little bit of time in my life as a clinical physician. It was a very little time. So I do get how things work on the other side. I don't claim, obviously, I'm not some, you know, master clinician. I don't claim that at all, but I spend enough time doing it that I understand that what we say in the laboratory and what we, in particular, what we say in the transfusion service has sometimes real implications for patients and people taking care of patients. And I understand that sometimes we have to kind of accept a happy medium. And honestly, if the only message that people get from this, from our time discussing this stuff today, you guys, is what I said before about hemolytic reactions can fool you. If even that leads to somebody looking a little more closely and thinking a little bit more and maybe watching someone a little bit more carefully, even if they do decide to do that, you know, give them some Tylenol and go on thing, even if they do that, but if they, you know, have the patient monitored more carefully, maybe slow down the rate a little bit, you know, no blood banker anywhere will say, hey, perfect, that's great, you got it. But I would take that over, just go, don't worry about it.
Well, and I think, you know, I mean, there's probably certain examples, but like you said, in the most extreme case, you could say, well, we'll just send you more blood, right? Even if it means we have to throw a unit out, we'll just send you more blood so that we can take care of the patient. And I find, you know, my version of this for you, right, is people who do kind of a half-assed job at sedation and airway management, and people who say, you know, like, I have a patient that I need to do some IR procedure on, and I just want to give them propofol and not intubate them, and I go, well, that's a horrible idea. You shouldn't do that. And 90% of the time, I feel like their objection to it is, it's really going to inconvenience me, right? Mm. It's not that the patient's going to die or suffer. It's just really going to kind of mess up my day. And I don't want to wait for an hour until we can get an anesthesiologist down here. And this is sort of the same thing, I feel like, in a lot of cases, right? Yep. Because worst case scenario, I throw out a unit of blood, you give me a new unit of blood, boom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, which we shouldn't just be too cavalier about throwing out a unit of blood, right?
No, you're right. And we try not to be. That's, you know, I spent much of my career overseeing blood donation centers and dealing with, in my most recent job, dealing with the blood supply during the pandemic for 80 plus hospitals with almost nothing on the shelf. It was a horrifying experience. So I'm more sensitive than probably just about anybody when it comes to wasting blood. I hate wasting blood. It's a gift that someone has taken their time to come in and inconvenience themselves and literally give a piece of themselves altruistically to someone else. And we give them at the end, hey, here's a nice cookie or a crappy t-shirt. You know, I mean, it's it's amazing what blood donors do. It's amazing what they do. So I take their gift very seriously. But you're right. If it comes to that, if it's for the safety of a patient, if I need to discard a unit, I'll do that if I have to.
All right, Joe. Closing thoughts. What do you want our clinicians to take away about transfusion medicine?
You know, I think the big thing to know is that you're just not alone. There are resources available for you. There's, you know, to things to educate yourself include, there's a whole lot of stuff online. My website, bbguy.org, blood bank guy website, and the podcast that I do is designed for people that don't know a heck of a lot about transfusion medicine. And I interview people that are experts and talk about things in a way that could potentially, I hope, be really helpful. I mean, lots of examples include, you know, discussions I've had on the current movement in trauma to go towards low titer group O whole blood and figuring out how that is going to come into play in trauma settings. And I'm not trying to make this a commercial. My point is there's a lot of online resources, but more importantly, even in your hospital, you're not alone. The pathology department, now I will grant you, not all pathologists love transfusion medicine. I freely admit that. But all of them that have clinical pathology training, which is the vast majority of pathologists, at least have some background in it. And they know enough to have conversations with you and help you when you're struggling, and know enough to when they need to get help from their local blood center. My point is, you're not by yourself. You don't have to figure all this out by yourself. Use the resources that are available to you. And in the end, patients get better care. That's really all we're all looking for, is just for the patients to get better care.
All right. Last question. It's August 2024. 1 to 10, where are we at in blood shortages?
Currently, nationally, I would say 1 to 10, it would be about a 5 to 6, but it varies by day. Some days platelets are incredibly short and difficult. Platelets have a super short shelf life. We only keep them either 5 or 7 days. Platelets are always more fragile. But I guess what I would tell any of your listeners is that there's enough of a shortage still, not like it was during the pandemic, but there's enough of a shortage still that if you're eligible, man, we could use you. We really could. And just find your local blood donor center and help us out. It's a great thing to do. And the cookies are not bad. I got to tell you, they're okay.
Yeah. Remember the rule. If you transfuse blood, you got to go donate a unit.
That's bam, right. Exactly.
All right. Well, Joe, thanks for joining us. We'll just remind everyone, these are all just our own opinions, not those of our institutions, and just kind of general medical education, not any specific medical advice. We'll talk to you next time.